honey, it's getting too hot in L.A.
Well, let's call it the Uber and head for Vancouver.
We're Canadians for global warming. All this talk of doom and gloom is really such a bore. We say don't believe those awful warnings. Now someone please shut up that inconvenient Al Gore. There's no need to worry about the glaciers or the penguins. All this talk of politics is really getting old. Besides, we're getting tired of wearing these big parkas. Canadian weather's too wet and cold. So we're Canadians for global warming. America, we know that you really do care. 'Cause we see Pat Robertson on TV.
From Vancouver's Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, this is the Radio EcoShock Show.
Arctic ice is melting, polar bears are scrambling, the heat is all around, we've got to cool it down, cool it down. Appealing to the masses to cut our greenhouse gases down.
This is Radio EcoShock, your weekly blast about the state of the planet. As part of the tide of rising public demand for information about global warming, the Vancouver Public Library teamed up with the Sierra Club to present a three-day climate change film festival called 2 Degrees. As you know, 2 Degrees is the estimated amount of warming we can sustain without vicious damage to human society and the ecosphere. There were 11 films on everything from big oil to sustainable energy and disappearing water resources. Dr. Mark Jackard, the clean fossil fuels expert recently featured on Radio EcoShock, was one of many speakers. On February 24th, Radio EcoShock recorded a public panel discussion with Dr. Colin Campbell, MLA Gregor Robertson, and Bill Taylor. Dr. Campbell is the science advisor for the BC Sierra Club, and Bill Taylor is a climatologist working for Environment Canada, the government agency. This is Citizens in Action, meeting to learn and talk to one another about the grave threat posed by climate change. In today's show, we'll take you there. We'll start with short presentations by three speakers. In the second half of the hour, we'll hear comments and questions from the audience. That's you, Vancouver. First, I want to mention a couple of key news stories breaking just this week. As you know, I have been wailing and ridiculing the construction of new coal plants around the planet while the skies fill up with their deadly carbon. Last week, the Campbell government in British Columbia announced two proposed coal plants would require 100% carbon capture and storage to make them climate safe. That still left a mega project in Texas where the utility TXU and State Governor Perry were rushing to construct 11 new giant coal-burning power plants before any carbon regulations could be passed by a democratically controlled Congress. Despite protests by hundreds of thousands of Americans, led by local citizens and national environment groups, the project seemed unstoppable. Then a combination of Wall Street firms announced a takeover bid for TXU for an astounding $45 billion this week. Part of the deal was a truce with two national environmental groups, the Environmental Defense Fund and the National Resources Defense Council. The Wall Street boys, including investment brokers Goldman Sachs, had secretly been negotiating with Fred Krupp, the CEO of Environmental Defense. In the announced deal, 8 of the coal plants would be scrapped, leaving just 3 new ones. The new owners would put hundreds of millions of dollars into developing alternative energy instead. And most important, the new TXU would commit to reducing its greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by 2020. This is a huge victory, where environment groups and financiers bypassed both the lax federal government of George Bush and the Texas know-nothing in the governor's mansion. It almost makes you believe humans may have just enough brain power to squeak through this ultimate challenge. Way back in 2005, I did a feature called End Coal Now, or The Earth Burns. That's still available at our website at www.ecoshock.org in the EcoShock Features section. It seemed radical then, but necessary. Today, I have good company. Top NASA scientist and climate expert Dr. James Hansen has called for a moratorium on all new coal power plant construction until carbon capture and storage technology can be installed. There are still more than 150 new coal plants in development in the United States alone, in a country blessed with more solar and wind power than anyone can imagine. So we have a long way to go, but there are more voices for sanity out there. I also have some sad news today. A great-grandmother who defended both Aboriginal rights and the environment has died. Activist Harriet Nahni was hospitalized with pneumonia just 1 week after her release from jail. A judge put her there for protesting against destruction of a wetlands for the highway bypass on the new Sea to Sky Highway being built for the Olympics. According to reporter Zoe Blunt, previously your host on the CFRO program Green Monkey, the well-respected Nahni, age 71, was weak from flu and asthma when BC Supreme Court Justice Brenda Brown ordered her to the Surrey Women's Pretrial Center in January. Another granny protester, Betty Croswick, age 78, was also jailed in the same case. Croswick, realizing Harriet Nahni's fragile health, had urged Justice Brown not to send Ms. Nahni to jail. Last week, the University of Victoria hosted a forum called Are We Killing the World's Oceans? The keynote address was given by our own Dr. Daniel Pauly, the director of the Fisheries Center at the University of British Columbia. We'll be recording a speech by Dr. Pauly when he appears as part of the Vancouver Institute series on March 10th. That lecture is free at the Woodward Instructional Resources Center at 8:15. Google the Vancouver Institute for details. As reported in the Vancouver Sun, the outlook for our oceans is very bleak. Various nations are in a mad rush to grab the last of the edible species before they go extinct. The ozone hole continues to grow, damaging essential plankton in the southern ocean. And Dr. Caldera explained the oceans are becoming more acidic than at any time since the age of the dinosaurs. That is because the ocean is absorbing so much of our carbon when it then turns to acid. That is one reason the coral reefs are bleaching white and dead around the world. This is so important. Even if we could block the sun's rays by geoengineering, a horrible thought, we would still have to axe our carbon emissions because they are poisoning the ocean. To find out more about that, check out Elizabeth Colbert's article in the November 20th, 2006 issue of New Yorker magazine called Underwater Apocalypse. You can just Google that. Sadly, the organizers of the UVic conference decided not to record these very important speeches, so it all disappears into the memory hole. Please, if you're going to bring together experts on the killing of the world, turn on the recording device so we can all learn from it. Enough said. The music you heard at the start of the show is a new song from Raffi called Cool It, and we'll play the whole thing in just a bit. Let's go to the Climate Crisis Film Festival for the speakers and the comments from the citizens who want action. Now, it gets lively. We begin with Dr. Colin Campbell, science advisor to the Sierra Club.
Well, thank you, everybody, and thank you very much to my colleagues in this local branch of the Sierra Club. They do terrific work. We don't always see a lot of them from Victoria, but I hear it's been a great success. Now, we have experts here today on political and the scientific aspects of climate change, and although the Sierra Club works in both those areas, I'd like to take a slightly different tack. I think we've all probably here got a fair idea now what some of the scientific and factual issues are around climate change. Like, we know, for instance, that if we're going to stabilize our atmosphere at something like its present greenhouse gas concentrations, then we really can't afford to emit any more than the Earth can take up. And right now, if we were equal about it, a little more than half a ton per person, whereas we produce about 4.5 tons of carbon, greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, and others. So that implies that we have to reduce our production of greenhouse gases by about 85% just to stabilize where we are now. And if we wanted to go the extra step and be relatively sure that we weren't going to exceed a 2-degree overall heating of the Earth, we'd have to remove about 30 parts per million equivalent of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And just in actual mass, that's equal to about 8 years of production at 2005 levels. So I don't think any of us are in any doubt anymore that we're facing something massive. And rather than go into any more of those kind of details, I think like myself, I'm sure many of you have had this sinking feeling in your stomach lately that somehow or another this thing is big and we've unleashed a bit more than we can retrieve. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because I think managing our own worry is going to be as difficult as managing the actual issues that are before us. So for me, the way I do that, it's got a lot to do with the way I perceive the planet and the fact that I'm alive on this place with all those other things that are alive. And I was trained as a paleontologist back in the 60s and 70s. And you won't be surprised to know that paleontologists, more than any other profession, have time travel fantasies. You know, it's like we end up being with deep familiarity with geological and fossil evidence. And we all think that, you know, we just yearn for that personal privilege of going to the past in real time and having a look at it. Well, of course, it doesn't happen really, but I have to say that more and more I'm seeing an uncanny resemblance of what's going on day by day right now to how I imagine things would look if I was doing time travel. Processes and events that would normally take millions of years or thousands or even millions of years to unfold are literally happening in the dimension of human lifetimes. So it's a peculiar time for a paleontologist. I have to admit to being vaguely excited, but on the other hand, terribly worried about how this is coming out. Having a strong and affectionate relationship with the planet and life, I think, is important. And one way I've come at it is by remembering, and I'm going to just list for you, a short sequence of things that made the Earth the way it is, things that had to happen for this to happen. And the very first one was this fortuitous collision between two bodies that spun off the Moon and the Earth. The Earth grabbed the core. The Moon ended up being quite large but light. So here we are with a small planet, a big core, lots of radioactivity inside to keep it warm and stirring over, and a Moon just the right size to make the kind of tides that we need in an ocean that wouldn't be there if we weren't just the right distance from the sun. So you can see it's the probabilities are starting to look short, but they do add up. Very early after the emergence of the Earth, in less than a billion years, there's life. Simple life, microbial, bacterial life. And the sun, being the way it is, relatively constant, we're able to get the atmosphere transformed from a fairly poisonous, reducing atmosphere to this highly energized, oxidizing atmosphere with oxygen. 2 billion years for that to happen. And really, this kind of life that we are couldn't have happened without that. And also, just a little more arcane perhaps, but interesting, is the phenomenon of plate tectonics and continental drift. This internal turnover of the hot interior of the Earth creates continents, creates mountains, exposes minerals which react with carbon dioxide that's constantly being coming in from volcanoes. So this thing manages the global atmosphere and the global temperature on the long time scale. And then, of course, there's life itself that manages the atmosphere on a shorter time scale. And also this magnetic phenomenon of moving metallic contents in the middle of the Earth gives us a magnetic field that protects us from the worst of the sun's incoming radiation. So, you know, it's an unusual place. I mean, it's an amazing place. It's not very big. We've all seen, you've seen the Gore movie, you've seen the one pixel view of Earth from a long way out, and all of this has happened here. I also just like to note to you, and this, then I'll finish with this little encapsulated Earth history, it can't last forever. The sun gets hotter. The greenhouse effect that actually gives us the warmth we need has to get less and less effective as time goes by. And somewhere in the future, in a little bit more than 500 million years, we're down to 150 parts per million of carbon dioxide and photosynthesis won't work. So there's a natural terminus to the suitability of this planet for life. And it's got about a 12 billion year lifetime, and I want to reassure you that we're in the best billion years of the Earth's history. So there's this cascade of improbable events that puts us where we are now. But more than that, where we are now is that we've become responsible. Like, we're the guardians of this great process. It's clear that our impact is geological in its scope, and we have to look after the inorganic and the organic processes and those other species who are in our thrall of activity. So here we are. We have to do this. We have to become the caretakers. And I think we need to do this with a couple of things in mind. One, a certain amount of gratitude, because these experiences are rare in the universe. And the other one is creativity, because our creativity and our ability to work together is going to be called upon like never before. So at a personal level, what I suggest is get out your camera, get out your binoculars, get into the world, learn a place deeply, and maybe choose a group of organisms and learn them deeply. I think without that, without taking that time to be present to what this thing actually is, the scope and the worry and the intensity of what we have to achieve in our lifetimes and for the next several generations could be just too depressing to manage. And I think I don't really know what else to suggest. I'm interested in this discussion. This is my first attempt to deal with the fact that managing ourselves is as big a deal as managing everything else. So thank you for your time, and I look forward to your questions.
That was Dr. Colin Campbell from the Sierra Club. We're listening to the panel speakers from the Climate Crisis Film Festival, presented by the Vancouver Public Library and the BC chapter of the Sierra Club.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Join us every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Next up, a government climatologist, Bill Taylor from Environment Canada.
Hello, everyone. My name is Bill Taylor. I'm a climatologist with Environment Canada. My background is actually in meteorology, and about 20 years ago, I decided that I just had to become a weather forecaster. And so I actually quit my the career I had at the time, went back to university, got my degrees, went on, got hired by Environment Canada, got trained as a weather forecaster, applied for a job as a climatologist, and never wrote a single weather forecast because of my new position. So it's interesting how one's career can take sudden dives and turns. But anyway, I've been involved in climate work now for about the past 10 or 12 years, and first really became interested in it when Environment Canada produced something called the Canada Country Study. And my boss and I were involved in doing the BC and Yukon chapter of this Canada Country Study. And what it was a review back in 1997. So this is at a time when climate change and global warming was really just sort of emerging in people's minds and getting on the agenda. And what the purpose of this was really just to report out on the impacts of climate change on BC and Yukon as they were understood at the time by the experts. So we pulled in people from the provincial government who study forestry and people who study water and that kind of thing. And we asked them each to contribute a chapter to this book. And actually, it's 10 years later now, and I still get comments from people about how useful they find that publication just in terms of being kind of a first in terms of documenting the impacts as we understood them then. And actually, if I had to list them, the lists that I would come up now are not really too different than the ones that we first identified back in 1997. And in about the past 10 years, I've been in a number of scientific projects aimed at just trying to improve our understanding of these issues and what we're going to need to do about them. So I would put at the top of the list water resources, and you know, I've been involved in a study in the Okanagan looking at climate change impacts on water resources. Of course, that the interior is wholly dependent on the winters, the buildup of the snowpack, for their water supplies to take them through the whole year. And as the climate warms, the amount of precipitation falling as snow is reduced. So we see the fraction of rain and snow changing. So, and also under a warmer climate, we see an earlier snow melt. So if we look at the trends in the snowpack over about the past 20 or 30 years, and this is not just for the Okanagan, but in fact, for the entire Pacific Northwest, we see declines in the April 1st snowpack. April 1st is the date we look at because it's the time of year when the snowpack is pretty much at its peak, and it gives the provincial planners a very good idea of the amount of water that's going to be available for the summer, especially in the interior for irrigation purposes. So in a place like the Okanagan, where agriculture consumes something like 70% of the water resources, this is a pretty critical element. So speaking of agriculture, I would identify that also as kind of an area that would be of interest, at least, because agriculture is one of those sectors that they say actually stands to improve as a result of climate change. So, and the reason that is, of course, is because longer growing seasons and areas that are currently not able to grow certain types of crops being able to do that. So we'd actually see an expansion of agriculture. But with that comes a couple of real problems. The first one is water. Where is the water going to come from? Because problem number one is water supplies. Also, pests increase with a changing climate. The third area I think I would suggest is in forestry. And we're all, of course, very familiar with the mountain pine beetle. And the reason that that infestation is in the state that it is today is because over the past couple of decades, we just haven't seen the really very, very cold temperatures that's required to keep that in check. So as the climate warms, ecosystems will shift northward and upward. And that was a statement that came out in the 1997 Canada Country Study. I thought, that's marvelous, you know. It just, everything shifts upward and northward. But as we look at that issue a little bit more closely, it's not as pretty as it sounds. And in fact, the problem is that species all migrate at different rates. And there are also obstacles in the way. So in the Okanagan, for example, we're going to see a great expansion, I think, of grassland and that pine ecosystem up into the Douglas fir and the Douglas fir zone moving, you know, up into the more cold-adapted spruce species. So these changes will happen, but there will be casualties along the way, and it is not just sort of a benign shift in things. So, of course, on the coast, sea level rise, in the north, thawing permafrost and all the implications that have. There are probably several others that I could mention, but I think that the main message I'd like to leave you with is that the warming that we are experiencing is happening. It's not something that we can say, you know, climate change is all future. It is something we've observed in the past record. We can see changes like glaciers, for example. There's probably no better example. And so in these various sectors that I've mentioned, agriculture, water resources, forestry, it's going to require us as a society to adapt to the new climatic equilibrium. And that it's in that adaptation that I think the real challenges are for not only us as a society, but for water resource managers, for politicians, and because there's going to be some tough decisions that we will face related to climate change. Thank you.
You've just heard Bill Taylor of Environment Canada speaking at the Climate Crisis Film Festival, February 24, 2007, and recorded by Radio EcoShock. You are listening to CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Listener-supported radio. Join us and forget the commercials. Just get the facts. Let's take a break to hear the new climate song by Raffi called Cool It. The video is currently available on YouTube. Just search for Raffi, spelled R-A-F-F-I. Dr. David Suzuki is in the video, as he was for Raffi's 1990 ecology album, Ever Blue, filmed mostly in Vancouver's Stanley Park. I was there that day, incidentally.
it down. Cool it, cool it down. Temperatures are rising. Arctic ice is melting. Polar bears are scrambling. The heat is all around. We've got to cool it down. Cool it, cool it down. Appealing to the masses to cut our greenhouse gases down. Wacky weather here, stormy weather there. Climate change is on us, the signs are everywhere. We've got to cool it down. Cool it, cool it down. Take shelter from the storm, come together, cool it down. Governments and CEOs, hear the people's call. Don't leave your engines idle, there's no time to stall. All around the world, in the country and the towns, there's a growing global chorus and it's ringing in the halls. Cool it, cool it, cool this planet down. Cool it, cool it down. Cool it, cool it, cool this planet down. Children, do it for yourself. Everybody's needed. Everyone can help to cool it, cool it, cool this planet down. Cool it, cool it down. Hear us singing. Cool it, cool it, cool this planet down. Cool it, cool it down.
Let's hear that guitar. Little bit of piano.
That was Raffi and Cool It. Now we return to the Climate Crisis Film Festival to hear British Columbia legislator Gregor Robertson, a member of the New Democratic Party.
Good afternoon, everyone. So I'm Gregor Robertson. I'm MLA in Vancouver Fairview. I am the critic for small business and revenue and regulation or deregulation, depending on the mood of the government. I am in the NDP opposition, and I'm fairly new to politics. I never quite imagined that politics would be my calling, but part of the reason that I'm standing here today brings those things together, the urgency of climate change and the necessity for us collectively to deal with it through our government, and the fact that for, well, the last 6 years anyway in BC, and well beyond that federally, we have not had responsible governments on climate change or generally on environmental issues. We have had much better luck here municipally. Vancouver is one of the global leaders as a city in terms of climate change and having an action plan for it and actually achieving a lot of the goals set out in that already. So we have plenty to be proud of, and Mayor Larry Campbell was a real driver of this, even though it wasn't in his background. A coroner that got it on climate change 4 or 5 years ago, and actually kicked it into gear, which was impressive. Seeing that, and I worked with Larry as a kind of green business advisor with a group of green business people, we were driving this and there was a lot of receptivity. It made me think, well, where is the receptivity in Victoria? Where is it in Ottawa? And why isn't there action on this? When we, in Victoria, we collectively pool about $32, $33 billion of our money, some of that generated by our resources. We should have a government that applies that very responsibly to the longer term, not just the immediate needs in an emergency room or fixing potholes, but for the long term, for our kids and grandkids and looking after things and stewarding all that we have here. So there I am plunked down in Victoria, and it's been a year and a half of absolute frustration. Last year's throne speech and budget, last year's throne speech did not mention the words climate change, and the budget had nothing in there of significance. There were six people working on climate change in the provincial government up until right now. So it was very frustrating to drive this and to raise it repeatedly in the House to an almost empty chamber most of the time. That's the way that place works. Most of the decisions are made in the Premier's office with a sort of small unelected executive council around him of advisors. And what happens in the House when MLAs from the Cariboo who are seeing literally millions and millions of hectares of their forests dying, and we're into double-digit millions of hectares that are gonna die. We have people from the Kootenays, we have people from up the coast that are hearing from fishermen, who are hearing from farmers, who are hearing from loggers. Things are changing way too fast. People who normally were very conservative, many would say redneck, all of a sudden are driving the issue. They're phoning and emailing their MLAs, and usually they were phoning them for the opposite reasons, because they were losing their job or there were potholes in the dirt roads where they live, or they wanted more access to the fish. Now they're calling and saying, something strange is happening in the world right now around us, and you better do something about it. And when we raised that in the House, it generally has been ignored for a year and a half. That changed markedly last week, a week before last, with the throne speech, when all of a sudden we hear all kinds of compelling and convincing language accepting that climate change is real, committing this province and this government of this province to doing something about it, which was great to hear. There were a lot of things in there that many of us in opposition had been raising for a year and a half as critical next steps. There were some longer range goals set, but what has really thrown us off in Victoria is the fact that they are all generally medium and long-term commitments. There is nothing in the short term. There is almost nothing before the next election, which is a pretty typical political maneuver. But it means that what we in the opposition called for a month ago, we are going to introduce a cap on emissions here in BC this year. So instead of our emissions curve climbing and climbing and climbing, which is what it's been doing for the last 6 years, we had it going back down in 2001 with a lot of programs dedicated to climate change and green economy. It has gone on a steep curve up again. We want to see that stop this year. There is no commitment to support that from the government side right now, but and I'll come back to what we can do about that. There are commitments to a 33% reduction by 2020. 13 years from now, and there are all sorts of useful programs that are and policy that are being floated out there, if you will. There has been no consultation. There has been a lot of raised eyebrows on the industry side as to how they're going to do it, but it's out there. There's nothing in the budget for this coming year, which was the big disconnect and the big disappointment a few days ago when we saw the budget for this coming year. There isn't anything there. So the skepticism meter shot back up again as to whether this government is going to take any meaningful action in the near term. And those of us who are there are going to, we have the opportunity now. It's on the table. There is a commitment to targets that's out there, and it's going to be very difficult to achieve them without taking some more immediate steps. So there, at least now we've got sort of a baseline to work with provincially. Hopefully we get that federally. It's still floating around there, but it does register as a really significant issue going into the next federal election. I just wanted to do a quick survey here. There was some polling information, a poll done just a couple weeks ago by Ipsos Reid on climate change, and I'm very curious how this room compares to the 750-odd Canadians who participated in it. The first question, raise your hand if you think climate change is real and caused by human beings. Maybe a couple of skeptics. Okay, 84% nationally is where we scored on that. This room's above the 84%, I would say. I mean, 16% still don't believe it. Interesting. And climate change, terrorism, pandemics, nuclear holocaust. Is climate change the number one threat globally right now? How many think climate change is number one on that list? I would say we are well above the 46% that put climate change as our number one threat globally. Terrorism was 22%, less than half. And if you compare the amount of money being spent right now on climate change versus terrorism and the war on terror, it's not double. The focus in the next federal election, how many of you think it should be climate change? Okay, yeah, I'd say we're above the 66%. You guys are above average on all this stuff. 66% believe it should be the focus, which is a good sign. And what percentage of people in this room think that Canada should take a leadership role in stopping climate change globally? Should we take a leadership role? Stopping climate change. Good luck to that. But 76% of Canadians think that we need to take a leadership role. How many of you believe, how many of you are willing to pay more taxes to stop climate change? Put your money where your mouth is. How much money? You get to decide who the government is, though. What you want to spend it on. Well, only half of Canadians are willing to spend more in taxes. So I think that's more of an indicator when all the numbers are higher than that about concern, it's more an indicator that there isn't trust in our governments to spend the money wisely and to actually dedicate it to that. And that comes to that question of, so what are our next steps here? And how do we create governments that we do trust? And how do we create businesses that we do trust? And I came to this before politics in business, trying to make a difference on issues like climate change and sustainability, and found it very difficult because most of the time when you're in business, well, there is a bottom line there to survive and to keep the jobs that you have in house, and there are choices that you got to make in your business. But increasingly, I saw businesses, and this is 5 years ago, businesses saw this coming. And this is from very small business right up to the global energy companies, were changing as quickly as they could because the drivers in the investment market, capital markets, the drivers in insurance, the indicators were already there. This is going to cost you, and you're going to be out of business if you don't adapt to it. The business or industry has been shifting at a very rapid pace to adapt. And that hasn't been happening nearly as robustly on the government side. And I think the problem there is that you get once every 4 years, maybe once every 3 years, a federal government once every year, you get to make a choice for your government, and then they go off and do whatever they want to do, and they got to get elected a couple years later, so they don't make 50-year plans. Most businesses are looking many more years out, even the ones that are doing quarterly profit statements. They're looking farther out there. They don't expect their business to last 3 or 4 years. They're looking a lot farther than that. They're able to make longer-term choices in terms of their investments and those decisions, and the feedback comes back every day. So in terms of next steps, those are the two votes you got. You've got your everyday votes for the businesses that you see are making a difference, the ones that you can actually tell, and the Internet is a great tool for this, and making local choices is another great tool for this. You can decide where your money goes every day and which businesses it supports. If you want to buy food that's flown on airplanes from the other side of the planet, you can do that, but you're contributing to the problem at that point. You can make that choice every day. And so there's immediacy and there's activism in that. When you vote, it's a much more weighty decision because you're giving up your tax base for years to come, and that's an important decision. that's not the end of your responsibility politically. And this is what I've been trying to push out there. And we have had very, very good response on the provincial government. The pressure in the last 3 or 4 months has been unbelievable. And you can almost feel it in Victoria over these last number of months, the pressure on the Premier's office and emails and letters and phone calls and people coming to forums like this, packing forums. There's been a lot of pressure, and that has created an immediate response. It has to follow up, though. It has to be almost in that daily cycle, a regular cycle, where you have to continue to put that pressure on. In a democracy, it's not every 3 or 4 years. It is every day. So any little bit that you can do to keep the pressure on the government in BC, the government in Ottawa, on a daily basis is very effective, and it will create the change that we all want to see. So keep up the pressure. Thanks.
That was MLA Gregor Robertson. You are listening to CFRO Co-op Radio 102.7 on your FM dial and live on the net at cooperadio.org. I'm your host, Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock, the all-environment radio show playing every Friday at 1 o'clock. If you miss a show, download it from our website at www.ecoshock.org. Questions or complaints? Email it to radio@ecoshock.org. We still have time to hear what the people have to say. I've selected some questions and answers from the audience at the Vancouver Public Library last February 24th. I suppose it's no surprise that people are both worried and yet full of suggestions on how we can tackle the climate problem. Here we go.
How can we change our government system? I think we have a government systems that are flawed. We have that one vote, but that individual we vote in then does what they want. The party we might vote for can change their mind, not do what they promised. I don't want to have a professional politician lead in a particular way. I want an expert on the subject to lead. For example, for education or the environment, I want an expert in those things to be leading. I don't want a professional politician that goes from one subject to another. And I want to vote myself on the issues. I even want to vote on what we vote for. And I don't want a government that's not leading. I want a government that's proactive. I don't want to have grassroots efforts trying to push governments to do something. I want the government to lead us. So how can we change our government systems?
My question is, how do we get the media to represent what the government is saying? And I'll give you an example. In the Journal of Commerce on February 21st, I'm reading an article of a presentation that Kevin Faulkner is giving to the construction industry about how they don't have to worry about anything because Gateway is a green project. And yet I don't hear any of this except if I look through trade journals, right? And it's like I'm hearing one thing and I'm hearing decisions being made that are totally opposite to what I'm hearing. And how do we get this, close the gap between what they say and what they do? Because, I mean, it's kind of acknowledged now that this Gateway project is the biggest obstacle to reducing our carbon emissions. It violates the livable regions strategy, the sustainability strategy, the smart growth strategy. And yet we have our Minister of Transport telling the construction workers, at the same time he's offering a $200 million contract to replace obsolete bridges. I didn't know that bridges went obsolete. Like, how come we're not hearing that in the news? How come we have to find out about it in obscure little trade journals? How do we close the gap between what the government says and what the government does? Thank you.
Very good question. We can start with the fact that the media are businesses, and that means they, by nature, don't necessarily have a conscience, and they, by nature, can be manipulated. Who they're taught, they respond to the needs of their customers. They're paying customers who are primarily their advertisers. And, you know, the mainstream media in BC is the most concentrated media market in North America, and well beyond compared to most places in the world. We're basically in an impossible mainstream media market to get truth told. And that means that whatever the government does can go through that filter. And most people that look at the CanWest empire and its publications and broadcasts are going to get a different twist on everything. So what can we do about that? Well, there are lots of alternative forms of media. A lot of people have turned to internet, and there are lots of great sources of independent media on the internet. The Tyee.ca is a local source that has lots of excellent journalism, and I would say is relatively unbiased and committed to taking those positions. So there's sources like that. And again, it comes back to, you know, it takes a certain number of letters and emails and phone calls and going into MLAs or MPs or city councilors' offices and actually confronting, expressing your opinion, being vocal about it, being forceful whenever possible about it. The same goes for the media, and they will respond to this. The readership of the Vancouver Sun and Vancouver Province has plummeted over the last decade. Their numbers are way down. Why? Because Vancouver is actually a very progressive city. The citizenry here is progressive and can't stand. After a while, it's like, well, how many people here read the Sun and Province religiously? maybe religiously was the wrong. But I mean, it's a good sign. There are a lot of people that have turned away from it. It's too much. At the same time, a lot of opinion leaders, a lot of politicians, I mean, that's what drives the activity basically in Victoria. People look at the media. What's going to get on Global? What's going to get in the Sun? What's going to be on the front page? That's what we're going to do today. And so we've got this little feedback loop working there between mainstream media and the government issues of the day. And most of you are completely out of the loop because of that. And we have to break that down. We have to go to other sources, and putting pressure on those media outlets is useful. If you do see a good story, if you do see something that you appreciate in terms of its perspectives, tell them that. Reinforce it. When you see stuff you don't like, tell them that. Pick up the phone and make yourself heard. They do respond to pressure from people, because they know that you are part of their customer base, and that's what keeps them in business. So I don't think we can completely try and ignore them and forget them. I think we have to push and kick and scream and do everything we can to try and make them as honest as possible and respond. And they have responded to the groundswell of pressure over the last 6 months. There's been way more coverage of climate change, particularly in the mainstream media. They can't walk away from it, and they do like to sell papers and ads, so they do respond when they know there's an appetite for it. So keep the pressure on the media, but most of the time pay attention to the independents.
I have more than one question, and my head is actually swimming, so I don't know. Excuse me. Number one, I would like to know, in which respect is Vancouver a climate or environmental number one city, or whatever you mentioned?
Vancouver has implemented a plan called Cool Vancouver about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, with greenhouse gas reduction targets in it, with a whole bunch of programs, regulation, and policy to support that. And it's one of the most aggressive municipal level or city level plans in the world right now. And there are, you know, it's easier for us to hit it because we don't have freeways all through the city. So one of the reasons that Gateway is a problem with Vancouver City Council is because it actually makes it very difficult to hit the targets that we've set. And it wasn't envisioned only a few years ago. We weren't expecting this.
Well, okay. If I compare European cities, and every European city would be number one, because I know they're burning a lot of garbage, but it's filtered so much that it's only 1/100th of 1%, I think, is released in the atmosphere. But it's being also used for heating apartments. Mm-hmm. Because with piping, apartments are connected, and entire buildings and office buildings are being warmed. So I never hear any about here in Vancouver. So I don't know how they're getting that title.
I wouldn't say it's an official title, and we do, where we benefit is that most of our electricity is generated by clean power, by hydropower, which is a legacy of previous generations.
Well, that's to do with Vancouver.
Well, most of Vancouver's electricity is, and we don't have a giant freeway network through our city, so...
Well, no European city has it either.
Exactly. Same thing, but all the European cities, for the most part, rely on coal, gas to power themselves.
What I would like to see governments are doing is putting some achievable goals into the hands of the people, you know, and making a limitation on hydro electric appliances are supposed to use. And the more the appliance uses, the more expensive the appliance is supposed to be. So there should be an extra tax on it. But I want to see that things, you know, you should make a list and say, okay, this is what we want in 1 year, and then in 2 years, this and this. So people, I like to see solar panels on every roof to heat their own home with hot water. Mm-hmm. Photovoltaic, I don't see that at all here. Yeah. They're building a new dam, what for? There's so many roofs here, you don't need a new dam.
So my question comes from the perspective of the way that we're trying to convince everyone that this is an issue is to talk about how big it is. But the way that we're talking about addressing it on a personal level, we have to reduce it down to small, incremental, manageable things. So based on that perspective and the fact that the three of you come from pretty different perspectives yourself, I'm interested to know what you think are, say, three relevant, specific actions that you think every citizen should take that would address this issue. And when I ask that, a lot of the answers that we get about things we can do is usually buy a hybrid car, for example. But realistically, not everybody has the money to afford that. Buying cars is not really the solution here anyway. So besides cars, I'd like to hear your perspectives on relevant, manageable things that each one of us can do.
So we'll go rapid fire, a couple things each.
Yeah.
someone coming from a food background, I'd say eat local is one thing you can start with. On many levels, it makes a huge difference to your health, and it makes a huge difference in terms of how much carbon gets torched, not getting the food here. And the second thing, and I think this is what's pointed out in a lot of the great books on it now, is don't take a plane trip every time you decide you might take it. If you start ramping down the amount of times you get in an airplane and fly far away, and choose a local option, or I know the love miles is the big complication, but we got to spread our love around in a more broad way, or keep it local. And so, you know, just start with reducing the number of air trips. Makes a massive difference.
I live in the southern part of the province, and so I'm taking a transit every day into work. My monthly transit pass is $130. I'd like to see free or virtually free transit passes.
Well, just for BC, the three biggest areas of consumption are transport, industry, and agriculture. So we have to deal, as has been suggested, with transport. And although I'm still guilty of owning a pickup truck, my excuse is that I have to go fishing once a year, so I ride a bicycle every day. Consumption is something we haven't really looked at. Industry is huge. It's something like 40%. And it's not just industry making smoke, you know. Everything they're making that smoke for is stuff that we want and stuff that we buy. And I think we just have to look at our material appetites. And this is going to be a tough one because of the way work and everything is lined up with that. And agriculture, I fully agree. Local food is by far the best way to go.
We have been tuned in to the panel discussion at the Climate Crisis Film Festival, presented by the Vancouver Public Library and the BC Sierra Club in late February 2007. Isn't it great to hear the public at work? We are way ahead of our government on this. Why wait until the world burns? Get active yourself. You'll find all the information you need with plenty of solutions at our website, www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock, like an electric shock, .org. It's free, no ads, nothing to sell, just speeches, interviews, and raw information to stoke your need to save this gorgeous and mysterious planet. Last week, we went out with a snippet from Global Warming Blues by Lenny Solomon. This week, I want to play the whole thing. The song was written 4 years ago and performed by the Lenny Solomon Band. You can buy their tunes from his website at www.arp.harvard.edu/people/Solomon. Missed that? Just Google Lenny Solomon and Band. Lenny knew about climate change early. He manages a climate research lab at Harvard when he isn't playing music. I'm Alex Smith. Join me next week for Radio EcoShock. Thanks for listening, and thanks for caring about the future.
He loves to go shopping in his SUV. A car that large is rocking, yeah, fits him to a T. When he gets behind the wheel, feels that engine whine. He doesn't think of the gasoline that he's burning all of the time. Will it be now or later when he gets a clue? Global warming is coming, baby, it's gonna get you. Well, I make so much money, I could buy me a continent. I'm gonna build me a trophy house with every compliment. A fridge as big as Venus, a stove as big as Mars. With all the modern conveniences, you see, I'm a star. Will it be now or later when he gets a clue? Global warming is coming, baby, it's gonna get you. Well, the glaciers are all melting and the Arctic's turning green. Polar bears have seen their lairs go floating downstream. Harp seals have changed color, they're no longer white. And our bronze complected and extremely uptight. Will it be now or later when he gets a clue? Global warming is coming, baby, it's gonna hit you. Glaciers are all melting and the Arctic's turning green. Polar bears have seen their lairs go floating down a stream. Where the harp seals have changed color, they're no longer white. And our bronze complected and extremely uptight. Will it be now or later when it gets clue? Global warming is coming, baby, it's gonna get you. Global warming is coming, baby, it's gonna knock you on your face. Yeah, it's a huge disgrace, global warming, yeah. Oh, SPF 163, all that's left for you and for me, global warming. One, two.